It's time for Intersections, where art and science meet, your weekly hour of conversation, where you learn about curious ideas, creative works, and interesting phenomena with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman-Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Now, it's time for Intersections, where art and science meet.
I'm Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, where we create a museum without walls so artists, scientists, and the community can create unique interactions and conversations. In today's show, we're going to have a conversation about a new exhibit of environmentally themed work in the Littleton Museum in Littleton, Colorado, that embraces the complexity of our relationship with plastics, and in the hope of inspiring a larger conversation within the community. And I have with me the artist that was responsible for the pieces that are in the exhibit, and it's Calliope Manios, who's an environmental artist. Did I get that name right?
Pretty close, yeah.
Pretty Calliope. Close. I'm getting close. Yep. but I want to talk about, you know, this is really, really interesting. So plastics, and it's to start a conversation about plastics. It just sounds like the perfect combination of art and science. So talk to us a little bit about that exhibit.
Sure, sure. It was motivated by a bee in my bonnet that I had about the amount of plastic that I was throwing away. And I had just gotten onto the city compost system, which allows you to throw any organic materials into a big compost bin. And what you quickly realize is that what remains of what you throw out is just plastic packaging. And there's so much. And you know, we're a family that doesn't use a lot of plastic packaging. We try to go to the refill shops, and we don't use Ziploc bags. Sorry, is that?
They were fine.
Okay. we don't use Ziploc bags. And so it was really surprising to me how much plastic packaging we were actually using. So so that was the genesis of this idea, you know, 7-8 years ago. And what I've kind of uncovered is the fact that most people think about plastic, they think about bags and straws,
right,
which is a fine place to start. Bags are maybe not the best use of plastic, and straws, perhaps not either. But as I went down this rabbit hole, I call them plastic safaris. I realized that plastic is so much more than bags and straws, and that our entire modern life revolves around plastic. It's made possible by plastic. So I thought that was a really fascinating conversation to start, and what better way to draw people into that conversation than with art?
I think that's really interesting. So when I think, I agree with you, when I think about the word plastic and I think about the products, I don't think about some of the things that are in that category, like vinyl or, you know, there's all these things that we have another word that we use for it. But then when we start to think through all of those materials that are basically made from oil, and all they don't, you know, as we know, the universal solvent that nature uses is water, and they're oil-based. So that gives us an explanation for why they don't dissolve very easily. And they're very complex molecules. So they persist for a very long time. So I think this is really interesting. So what did you decide to do to make them into art pieces?
Well, I wanted to remove the utility from them. I think people have a hard time seeing through the functional object that they create. So what I wanted to do was transform them. And that's kind of the criteria for all of my artwork. If it's transformative, if you have to pause for a minute and figure out, wait, what is that? Then it's successful. So that's sort of the approach that I take. And what that means is I'm trying to remove it from the original use. And as you said so elegantly in the intro, to subvert it. And then that helps people realize that this material that we've only been manufacturing at scale for 70 years and that has taken over virtually every other material that we've used for millennia in construction, in transportation, in what we wear, in medical fields, in medical devices, right? I mean, this is a wonder material. And like I said, it really makes modern life possible. And I want people to realize that, right? And to fully understand our relationship with it and how it has transformed modern life. So by taking away the functionality and instead emphasizing its beauty and curiosity, trying to spark awe, those are tools that I use to get people to look at it in a new way.
Wow. And so is it a variety of three-dimensional art? How would you describe the pieces? Is it a combination between sculpture and flat?
That's correct. Yeah. I guess you would call it mixed media if you're in the art world. But I'm actually using a number of techniques very intentionally that have moved human society forward all these millions of years, or I guess hundreds of thousands of years. Let's be accurate. And those are, you know, things like weaving, embroidery, sewing, quilting. These are ways that we came up with to bind materials together, make them into useful objects. And I think that it's really interesting, you know, those aren't typically techniques that are highly valued in the fine art world, but I think it's a wonderful commentary to use them with plastics, because plastics are largely undervalued in our society, right? The term plastic is equated with cheapness. It's equated with maybe even, what would you say, like, not fraud, but, you know, it's not the authentic deal. If you're plastic, you're not the real deal.
Yeah, right? Maybe like faux.
Faux, yeah, exactly. Yeah. Certainly not the most valued material in society. And yet, it's possibly the most common material, most ubiquitous, right? And if like aliens came down tomorrow to our planet and said, show us around, they'd be amazed. What is this material, plastic, that everyone thinks is disposable and useless, that really lubricates modern life and makes it possible? It's, you know, they would be shocked that we treat it the way that we do. So I like this parallel of the techniques and these crafts, really, that are generally looked down upon, maybe, by large portions of society, but that are really workhorses in our society. They've gotten us to where we are. And then that parallel with the actual material that we're also undervaluing.
Well, can you describe then one of the pieces to me physically? What's in it and the colors and that kind of thing?
Sure. So the most spectacular piece in the show is actually a year's worth of plastic that I had a family of four collect in 2019. And it documents basically their entire year. It's like a little journal of plastic, but it's not little, it's enormous. We washed them and we sewed them. I sewed them together into these long banners. Each banner represents a month worth of plastic, and they start at the ceiling height and they come down the gallery wall and then spill out onto the floor. And the entire wall is 26 feet long and it fills it entirely. And then it comes out and the longest banner is 26 feet long. So it's this 26 foot by 26 foot patchwork, crazy quilt with wild colors, brands you recognize, brands you wouldn't necessarily recognize, clear plastic from cereal bags and cracker bags and stuff like that. It's just a total hodgepodge, but really fascinating when people approach it. You know, the size is intimidating. I hope that they're making comparisons about, gee, we use much more than this, or whoa, we probably don't use that much, but this is crazy. You know, I hope that it sparks that kind of reaction from people. And then of course it's fun. It's like a treasure hunt. Oh, check it out. Look, Oreos. Oh, check this out. Snickers, or, you know, whatever treats you find in there that you recognize from your own life. So that's one kind. The emphasis there, of course, is just on the sheer volume that we produce. But then I have very sort of starkly different pieces too that are extremely minimalist, calm, embroideries, white on white. If you can imagine just a 20 inch by 26 inch rectangle, and it's an embroidery made of dental floss, because a lot of people aren't aware that dental floss is plastic, but most of it is. Most of the commercial brands are plastic, and particularly the Glide satin flosses, those thin, lovely flosses, they're very beautiful, are a particularly durable plastic called Teflon. And I just love that people use this thing, this material that will last millions of years in the environment untouched for picking food out of their teeth. And of course, the statement in these embroideries is maybe it would be better used for, you know, high culture, and an artistic statement that could last for millions of years and serve archaeologists of the future rather than picking food out of our teeth.
Or reused.
Yes. You know? Well, yeah. So the floss is not reused, I have to say.
But potentially it could be.
Sure, you could wash it. I mean,
made it with Teflon, it should be able to be cleaned easily.
Totally. So if anyone is out there who wants to clean Teflon floss for me, I'll take it.
That would be great. So what? There's two things that I'm picking up from really great descriptions, and that one of them is that in a way you're using these to weave together a story. And so there's a little bit of weaving. There's this idea of quilting, which I love, because quilts generally are a vehicle for telling stories, or traditionally they were. I can imagine that it makes a huge impact when you walk into the gallery space, so that you've got this kind of, you've got stuff flowing and moving, and then you all of a sudden realize that there's more to it than what you think. Is that what you're attempting to do with that?
Definitely, definitely. I started my career as a science illustrator in a paleontology lab, and by far the most valuable lesson that I learned from that lab was when I was making drawings, I would always ask first, who's my audience, right? And then there were some instances where it was very specific. Yes, my audience is a research scientist, or, you know, a peer review journal where only research scientists are going to be looking at this. Or sometimes it was a classroom, or, you know, we were age targeting whatever illustration we were doing, but sometimes it was broader. So the professor I worked for, Neil Shubin, he has written three popular nonfiction science books that had a really broad range, right? We could have AP biology students reading it in high school, or we could have retirees, you know, our parents reading it. So those illustrations taught me that the most successful art really can meet people wherever they are. So if somebody just comes to appreciate, walks into the gallery because they love quilting, right? Because their grandma quilts or they quilt, great, perfect, right? We have an opening. We have a way to pull them in. If then they take something else from it, if they're like, wow, look at these snacks. These are made from snacks. This is crazy. Cool. I've brought you into the next level, right? Then maybe they're thinking, wow, this is a really big quilt. Right? This is enormous. Or, right. So then I've got them to the third level. So this idea of tiered communication, where you can pull them in at a variety of levels. Maybe somebody just walks in immediately and they're like, blah, plastic, I get it. You know, maybe they're enthusiasts like I am about plastic pollution and how this material has infiltrated our lives. That's great. Awesome. We're already talking at the level that we need to. But for other folks, I like to kind of think about what might draw them in, and these varieties of techniques to try and pull into my work that might draw them in. So,
You're definitely speaking the language of what museum educators talk about, which is those multiple levels of entry into an exhibition. And we often talk about, you know, sometimes it's just something simply that we become acquainted for the very first time in a way, that's what you're talking about. Some people, that's the first time they've really thought about the scale of plastics.
Yeah.
And then you're taking them deeper as well. If they want to go deeper, then they start to really realize that it could be beautiful, you know, and that it could be used in a different way. And then you still leave them with that lingering question: is there plastics all around us, and we're not really thinking a lot about it? So yeah. you're creating that end provocation to go away. Still talking about, well, maybe I liked it, maybe it was beautiful, but maybe I also am concerned. I would think that people going away are going to be conflicted, kind of at times, and that's your goal.
I hope so. Yeah, exactly. Because I am too, right? And I think that a lot of environmental groups focus on the guilt and the shame. You know, you can instantly pull up images of plastic choked rivers, which are horrendous, and they motivate some of us, and they also motivate others of us to climb under the covers and put our head in the sand. And, you know, so my goal is I don't want to trigger that. We're all in this together. This is a system that we've created together, but we're an ingenious species and we can figure out a solution out of it if we're all thinking positively and moving towards a common goal, right? So that is my hope. You know, I'd like to mention one thing in the exhibit that that hasn't gotten a lot of airtime, but I think is really fascinating and drives home this point. In 2021, I created an installation in a public park here in Colorado, in Lakewood, Colorado. And it was three different types of plastic that were quilted together and then pinned to the ground in this public park so that they choked out the grass. They were pinned down in April and I removed it in October. So we got a full growing season and I was documenting it the entire time. And it was really beautiful when I first installed it. The colors were incredible. I used single-use plastic packaging, like I do in a lot of my quilting work. I also used black polypropylene landscaping fabric, which is ubiquitous. Anyone can get it at a Home Depot, you know, whatever right. hardware store. And then the third item that I used was white house wrap, Tyvek house wrap, Tyvek or Everbuilt. They're
right.
different brands, right? But that is actually number two plastic, HDPE plastic. Which I folded into origami triangles, modular origami triangles that kind of swooped around this knot. That was the name of the installation, knot, K-N-O-T. And so, but I left it out in the sun. Colorado typically gets more sunny days a year than Miami. So plastic, people might not know, plastic doesn't break down biodegradably. It doesn't biodegrade. There are not very many organisms that can break it down and use it for fuel, although there are a couple that we've discovered. But primarily the way that it breaks down is through UV degradation. So UV light breaks it down. And it did. Over the course of those 6 months, it began to break down. And I was able to document it. And one of my personal favorite parts of the exhibit are these photographs of the decaying plastic. And it's just it surprised me when I put it out there. I had no idea, you know, people aren't testing potato chip bags to see how quickly they break down in the environment. Although I would love if they would, but this was like a lesson in how microplastics are made. It was incredible. And so I have some photos of the degrading plastic in the exhibit, which are really fascinating, you know, close-ups of this plastic just turning to dust. And, you know, as we know, it's unfortunately that dust isn't benign. It's microplastics and they get into the waterways and they collect, like as you said earlier, they are petroleum based. So they are hydrophobic. They repel water, but they attract all these industrial chemicals like PCBs and DDT and then become a vehicle, like a little sponge with all these nasties that then can be small enough to work their way up the food chain and into our water and all this, you know, icky stuff. So it was a really fascinating experiment. And I'm really glad to be able to include that in the exhibit in the form of these photographs.
That's a fantastic description. The thing that I think very interesting in that was that you put them out and you really had an experiment going besides an art piece. And what did you find in that, that you put out there that went really fast, a lot faster than you thought it would go?
I love that you asked that question. I couldn't have set that up better.
Oh, good.
Yes, I have a plant in the audience. No, just kidding. So it was the amazingly, I would say 1 month into the exhibit, I was checking on this piece regularly, of course, because there were all kinds of unknowns. We were wondering, you know, would pieces fly off or would, you know, we certainly didn't want animals to be harmed by it or you know, anything. So, but the thing that really surprised me was I came back a month in and all, like half of the landscaping fabric was missing. I said, that's so bizarre. Like, did I not pin it down well enough? What's going on? And so I walked up close and it had dissolved. It was so this is fascinating. The Tyvek, the white house wrap, was perfectly preserved all the way through all 6 months. And it's not super surprising because if you look at the package on house wrap, it's rated for outdoor exposure for up to 6 months. You know, 6 months went by and it was totally, as you know, as far as you could tell, you know, on the macro level, it was perfectly intact. It was perfectly intact. They put UV blockers in materials in some of those plastics that last. The landscaping fabric, though, which is intended to be put under a layer of mulch, right? On the surface, it dissolved in 1 month. I couldn't believe it. I ended up having to replace it. And I tried to collect as much as I could responsibly to throw it away in a dumpster, but it just dissolved like you wouldn't believe. It was like, it just turned to dust and you could go poof and it would fly away. It was incredible. So that was the biggest surprise. The plastic packaging was also interesting because one of the problems with recycling plastic packaging and why it's not done more widely is because a lot of those materials are composite materials. You know, to us, we just have one word for plastic, but as you mentioned before, there are a trillion chemical names for plastic that describe all the different materials that qualify as plastic, but that are actually different enough that you can't just mush them up in a big pot and make a new plastic from it. It's just a mess. So that was a really interesting educational part of the installation as well, is that you could see, like, for example, if you think of like certain chip bags are silvery on the inside, it's because they have a very thin layer of aluminum. They're aluminized plastic. And freezer bags are not recyclable because they're a composite of multiple layers, some that breathe, some that, you know, prevent freezer burn. They have all these different functions. So you could really see that on display. It was very interesting.
That's, I mean, there's so many levels to this, but one of the ones that you were just talking about that I love is this idea that it doesn't really go away.
Yes.
So you think it does, you know, so here's one of the things we think it's being reapportioned by nature, right? It's being recycled like everything else. The truth here is it's just decomposing into something much more ubiquitous in a way, much more pervasive because those little particles are still there. And
right.
So I could imagine first I was going, oh yeah, we ought to make landfills where we just leave all the plastic out, right? And let it dissolve. But then I'm thinking, no, we shouldn't, because that's a worse state if it dissolves than it is if we bury it.
Exactly.
I had never really thought of it that way.
Yeah. And it's going to become more prevalent. We're on the edge of understanding how these microplastics turn into nanoplastics and then just work their way into us. There was a recent paper published about finding microplastics in people's lungs. There are papers that show basically every surface on the planet has them because they get small enough that they can be transported by air. And we certainly don't have the ability to pull them out of our water supplies. So there have been studies that show plastic samples in bottled water and tap water and stuff like that. So yeah, it's a really big problem. And it's easy to go out on Earth Day and get cleanup crews to pull plastic out of our environment because we can wrap our hands around it. It's, you know, at that point, they're still intact. But what a lot of ocean advocates know and beachgoers can see if they look is, you know, it's not staying large, it's breaking down. So yeah, that's a big problem we're going to have to solve. So let's start raising awareness.
Yeah, and that's exactly what your exhibit is intended to do. We have to do it through the magic of radio, and you did a great job of describing, but the whole idea of being able to see some of these things, I'm sure that visually it creates exactly what you were saying, which is this kind of conflict inside of you. Beauty is there. Oh, this is wonderful. I can't believe she did this. To, wait a minute, this is plastic?
Yeah, right? Exactly. You
know, and we have the bad side of that we know about.
Right.
Wow, that's amazing. I've been talking with our guest, Calliope Munoz, about her work creating a new exhibit that's environmentally themed around plastics. And we'll have more conversation after a short break.
Join us for the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artists Series on Saturday afternoons at 2 o'clock. Host Michael Toulouse brings you his fine commentary as we showcase faculty and visiting artists performing exceptional concerts and recitals from the Crystal DeHaan Fine Arts Center on the University of Indianapolis campus. That's the University of Indianapolis Faculty Artist Series, Saturdays at 2 p.m. on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. I'm Mark Kiesling, and we're having a conversation about how someone goes about as an artist creating an exhibit out of plastics, and why would someone create an exhibit out of plastics? And our guest has really, I think, described to us really well the kinds of efforts that she's doing. But I really want to know more about the weird things that you've actually tried to use in designing a piece. And I know just from talking to you briefly that contact lenses are one of them, which that just kind of blew me away. So you want to describe that?
Yeah, I've developed quite a reputation when I go for my eye doctor's appointment or my dentist appointment. I'm like, let's talk about dental floss or let's talk about contacts. So at some point I had this realization in my plastic safari days that the contacts that I wear every day and absolutely love are plastic. They are a silicone, some kind of crazy advanced silicone material. And if you've ever taken your contacts out when they're quite dry, and maybe you've left them on your counter once or twice, they turn into, they'll completely harden. And when they're not bathed in their saline solution, and you can make these really beautiful little blue spheres out of them. So being the weirdo that I am, I asked my eye doctor if they ever have extras. And it turns out that they do. You know, they, in those offices where they have samples that they hand out to you, when they stop carrying a line of contacts, they'll just throw out enormous numbers of them. So I became their contact collector and started making little itty bitty sculptures out of those beautiful little spheres. And people love it. It's so surprising to them. They're such a pleasing little gorgeous blue color. And in my experience, they've held up pretty well. Now, I've only been doing it for a few years, so they're certainly not as archival as the dental floss, but they sure do spark some fun conversations.
So describe to me how, okay, so you've got these little and they are lenses, which mm-hmm. is even that they're not only just these spheres, but they're actually have different magnification. Mm-hmm. So how do you attach them together? I'm just really interested. How do you get these things to be as part of a sculpture?
I suspect there's some cool physics going on. I mean, they're because of their shape and they are really attracted to each other. Huh. So I'll take one, and you know how they have that lenticular shape.
Yeah.
You can pop another one on sort of two-thirds of the way on its edge, and then another one and another one. And they generally, but they like to hold together because they're quite wet when you're sculpting them. Wow. And they just, their form makes it so that they easily, you know, it takes about 12 or 15 to make a little sphere. And I generally do it double thickness so that there's a little more integrity to the wall when it shrinks and dries. But yeah, it's really fascinating. And actually one of the really interesting conversations that was sparked from that was at the eye doctor, talking to my doctor. She asked me if I was happy with my lenses and if I wanted to change brands, and specifically change to a daily contact lens. And I said, you know, I can't do that because of the nature of my work. I can't stand how much packaging I would be using. You know, right now I use monthlies. So that's 24 of those little plastic pods a year. But if I were doing dailies, oh gosh, that's like 700 something, right? So no, thank you. And she said something really interesting, which I think brings up a fascinating point about how we think of recycling and how we use it as a crutch in our society. And that is, she said that there was a study done by whom I'm not sure, but that calculated the amount of plastic used in dailies versus those used in monthlies. And surprisingly, you use more plastic, they say, in the monthlies. Why is that? Because people use saline when they also use monthly contacts, and you don't need the saline solution when you're using the dailies because they're sterilized in their packet. You just open them up and then you throw away the packet, right? And she said, but in any case, those packages are recyclable through another one of these companies that does hard to recycle, that collects hard to recycle items called TerraCycle. And those guys can collect it and recycle it. And I said, well, that's great, but there are two things that aren't super great about that. One is that you can only recycle plastic a couple of times before it starts to degrade and become unpredictable in the manufacturing right. process. I'm not sure exactly what the problems are with it, but you could imagine that that might be the case. And or it's just less desirable than the virgin plastic, where you know how it's going to behave. It's virgin plastic, meaning first use, like it's just been manufactured and you use it, right? So I thought that was really fascinating that the doctor, and all of us do this, was using this idea that, oh, it's recyclable, therefore it's okay if I use a ton of it. She was using that as kind of like a something to soothe her guilt for using so much, right? And I'd really love to think about in some of my future work how to approach that and start talking about that in my work, because I think it's a really critical point that we need to wake up to. If you think about it, every single piece of plastic that has ever been manufactured since the 50s is pretty much still on the planet. I think estimates run in the range of 8 to 9% has been recycled, maybe, but even if it's recycled, it's still on the planet.
Right.
Right. So I think that that's a really important thing to keep in mind. If you have a leak in your house, it's totally logical if you get the rags and you start mopping up the leak. But if you don't turn off the faucet, you're going to make yourself crazy mopping up that leak, right? If you don't find the leak and shut off the water, the same applies with the plastic, right? We can recycle till our face turns blue. It's not going to do anything if we're still producing 360 million tons of plastic every year.
Yeah, you know, what's really interesting in here, and you know, I think we do rely on that almost that myth that we can recycle. And I think that comes from, because there are some things that we do recycle really successfully. Glass. You know, glass persists in the environment longer than anything we almost know. It doesn't, you know, it can't be remade very well, but it can be recycled quite well. And that's, I think, because of the nature of it. It's not very porous. It doesn't take on things. The nature of plastic, as you were talking about, and that would also take away from its recyclability, is that it is fairly porous, just absorbing things. So we might not want to use it in something that we want sterile or to drink. The other one is we're used to cans, metal cans. Those are completely recycling, at an advantage to the environment if we do actually recycle them.
Right. It's cheaper to recycle it than to mine new aluminum.
And to buy new aluminum. So The really interesting thing is we've got ourselves looped in there. And so we think, okay, these things work. But I was thinking just a common soda straw. A lot of times that comes to you, it's a complex plastic. It's not easily recyclable because of the way it's designed and its size. And then often, crazy enough, it comes in a plastic wrap, not a paper one. That's a different kind of plastic.
Yeah.
And goes into a plastic cup sometimes. It's a different kind of plastic with a plastic lid that's another kind of plastic. And we start getting into that whole idea of how many plastic things, right?
Yeah.
Take. And I was thinking of your contacts. So I would argue back also, just like you were, that, well, how much plastic was used to package each little tiny daily piece?
Right.
Not just the plastic in the contact, but how much plastic was in each encasement. Mm-hmm. And then take it beyond that and say, well, how much does it take to make all those in terms of energy, to transport all that in terms of energy, right? And not have it last for a long time. So, you know, it's an interesting thing. I wanted to tell you one really funny story and tell the listeners, but my background's in museums, and we collected at the Children's Museum in Indianapolis. We tried to collect some of the early plastic things. And one of them was a plastic that was made for use around sealing the Apollo astronauts. That was one of the first uses. And there was a seal around the door.
Cool. Right?
And that became a toy. Somebody thought of that as a toy, and it became the Stretch toys, Stretch Armstrong, Stretch something else, right?
Yeah.
And so museums like to collect things in their original box untouched. Mm-hmm. So we collected a bunch of these. And then we wanted to use them in an exhibit. And it was only about 5 years later, we went and opened the box, and all there was liquid. So what happened was they did continue to break down, making them soft. And then we started to find that baby dolls did the same thing. The softer we made the skin, the more they broke down, because the chemical reaction was there to make it soft. And so this is interesting. It lasts. However, it doesn't last in its form.
Yep.
And so that makes it really hard to imagine how I would ever reuse it, because I can't, you know, do it like other parts of things.
Right, so. Right. And so one of the things I did in a previous exhibit about plastic was bring in a modern art conservator. These are people who take care of the collections in museums, right? And of course, in modern art, a ton of us are using the materials that are available to us, which include lots of plastic. And that was the whole point of that exhibit. It was called The Plasticine in 2020, I guess. But I brought in a contemporary art conservator because her specialty is how plastics degrade. And oh, did she have good stories for us? Yeah, yeah. But you're right. I mean, that's part of the problem. And probably, you know, I asked the question about how plastic got this reputation for being cheap and less, you know, desirable or durable as its wood and bronze and concrete counterparts, right? And that's why. But you know, what you're talking about is that's. Is why because of all of the things that are added to it. It's not chemically, that's not right to say that it's not chemically stable, because it just turns into smaller pieces of itself. Right. But it doesn't stick together in the ways that would make it easy for us to clean up or to use long-term. So,
yeah, It runs counter to most things. Most things that break down can be recycled. Once they get smaller and smaller, they get recycled by nature. In other words, reused. So we get down to a basic element. What happens with plastics is that they do degrade, get smaller, but they don't ever get back to their basic element to begin with, which means nature has no use for them.
Yeah.
In a recycling process. And that's a problem.
Yeah. Yeah. Interestingly, my undergraduate degree is in geology. And what I see is, you know, when you go to a sandy beach, that is the result of millions of years of erosion to get, you know, giant mountains crushed down to this beautiful fine sand and sorted, right? This beautiful fine sand. And as a kid, you know, I was a nature lover, am still obviously, I would go to beaches and look for shells, right? Well, in 2016 or something, I went to Greece with my family. And instead of shells on the beach, I was finding these little pieces of plastic. And what I realized is, holy cow, the system that the earth has for erosion, breaking things down, is working on plastics just like it's working on everything else. Unfortunately, right? This is the result that it breaks down much quicker than in millions of years, and then becomes much more problematic to clean up and sort out. And, you know, we're going to suffer.
Yeah. And it's really because of a lot of things we go down that path, not knowing at the beginning of the path, it seems like a wonderful gift. Mm-hmm. Then we discover some of the hidden mystery of that gift later.
Yep. I like to think that we're in the adolescence of plastic, right? We had this wonderful baby childhood. Oh, plastic is so great. It makes life so wonderful. And now like some of the problems are starting to show. Oh,
yeah, you know that
friction.
It was when now, and some of those early on, remember it was inside of Teflon, for instance, and being used in pans and things, but it was wonderful. It made them nonstick, but then we realized it actually degrades.
Yeah.
And it degrades into things that you don't want in your food. And
totally.
So, yeah, it's really interesting. So many of us are going back to cast iron, you know, which does degrade, but in a way we can tolerate what it degrades to. So this is a really, the discussion we're having. So I also know that you do illustration and that kind of work. And so this is, what's really fun is to see the diversity of you moving to a more sculptural, more tactile 3D from what would have been a 2D kind of illustration. How did you make that transition?
Well, that's an interesting question. You know, this is a bit of a tangent, but I've been active in the Guild of Natural Science Illustrators for quite a number of years, 20 years now. And in the last sort of 10 years, I've been pushing them to organize, instead of by the medium that we use, by this shared message that we all bring and this commitment to communicating science through art. So for me, the tools that we use are less important than this shared mission of making science accessible, sharing the awe and the wonder and the joy that we find in the natural world with people, getting them to look up from their phones, engage with nature, engage with their surroundings. So those are the things that I think motivate us. And like the skills that we each have, okay, you know, whatever, those are the skills that we have. But what's more important is the goal, the motivating factor. But specifically to answer your question, I think I'm just naturally a person who thinks in 3D, and, you know, through my own, everyone thinks in 3D, but it comes more naturally to me to think about volume and how things sit in space. Drawing is a very, in my experience, contrived activity. It takes a lot of brain power to figure out how to trick you into thinking what you're seeing on a flat piece of paper is actually three-dimensional, right? For me, it's much more intuitive to actually make a thing. But people are different, of course, and there are plenty of people for whom drawing comes easily, and but not for me. That was a real, it felt like an acrobatics act for me to actually draw. That is how I started, and that was my entree into the arts as a profession. But if I'm operating in my own sphere with my own skills that I really enjoy developing, it's the 3D stuff.
That's so wonderful. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversations just like we're having. And we encourage you at home to take what you're hearing today and have conversations with friends and family and to further this idea of talking about plastics. And we'll be right back.
This is Jürgen Jungbauer from the Heidelberg House on Pendleton Pike here in Indianapolis. Join me this Sunday for German Music Hour. And even if you don't speak the language, I hope you enjoy the music and the rhythm and the beat on this radio station every Sunday at 1 o'clock. It's only here on 88.7 WICR.
Welcome back. We're having a conversation about plastics in art and art used as plastics and the inspiration that artists can get from that. But we have a really special guest who has really made it a work to not only make us appreciate plastic, but also to raise questions. And before the break, we were really talking about things that didn't degrade, and it just caused me to first prompt my head to think, well, we paint with acrylics, aren't those plastics too? And are we going to see that degrade? Or do we know if maybe acrylic paints won't be around? Oils seem to last, but acrylics, we just don't know.
It's a great question. And when we were talking earlier about the house wrap in which they put UV stabilizers, if you're using the professional grade acrylic paints, there are people, there are chemists who are putting in, you know, UV stabilizers to it's both to keep the pigments safe from fading. Of course, you know, as artists, we know that that pigments aren't stable and they'll change over time. And, but also I suspect that those UV stabilizers are also designed to keep the acrylic from breaking down, the acrylic binder. So in 2020, I did an exhibit at the Art Students League of Denver that was really a fun one because I wanted to show how plastic is ubiquitous in modern life. And so to do that, the tool that I used was showing that it's ubiquitous in contemporary art. And so I invited 15 contemporary artists locally whose work is just spectacular, but they were all using plastic in some way. And what was really fantastic about that exhibit is that most people would not look at their work and say, ah, plastic, like they would with mine. You know, like when you walk up to one of my plastic quilts, you're like, ha, that's plastic. But with these, you'd say, wow, that's modern art. the joy of that exhibit was pointing out all the different plastic tools and materials that these folks were using, including acrylic paint for sure. There was a woman who does these beautiful ink drawings on Mylar, which is a type of plastic that she would affix to a canvas, like a wooden panel. There was a guy who actually made his paintings on very thick acrylic sheet or plexiglass, as it's known. That was cool. Like he would etch into it. He would, you know, he does all kinds of great things. There was a woman who used acrylic paint, and her paintings are geological, landscape paintings. And she would actually go to these places, collect rock dust from these mountains that she was painting, and then grind it finer and put it into her paint. So there was actually pieces of geology in her paintings. And that was done with acrylic paint. There was a woman who was a collage artist, and her focus is data. And she would create these incredible collages of hand-dyed paper. But what made the paper stick is glue, and glue or acrylic medium is plastic. So it was super fun to point out all these different instances in which, you wouldn't think that your glue is plastic, but it is. You wouldn't think that this beautiful modern painting is plastic, but it is. So that was a really fun exhibit. We also had a woman who did these inflatable sculptures. They're these wild sculptures that are like reminiscent of microbes and fungi and neural networks. But they're like a big blow up, like the Santa and, you know, reindeer that people have on their lawns at Christmas time. It's like that, but a big modern art piece. And what she was using is this nylon fabric, which is plastic. So it was really a really fun exhibit.
That's really good. And why that becomes powerful is this idea that the artists are using this just like other people to do their job, right? I mean, they're adopting it. And when we think about it, that's kind of how we are in general with a technology, right? We adopt a new technology and we start using it. But it made me think when you were talking about that earlier, that when we were talking about house paint, the idea that we had to quit using a certain house paint that we put lead in to help with the weathering. You know, lead was helping us hold on to the pigment, but it was also helping us so that it didn't weather so fast. And then later we came to find, oh boy, that's really bad when that degrades.
Yeah.
Lead around the house is bad. And I wonder if we are going to unfortunately come to the same thing someday and somebody's going to go, oh, you got plastic in the ground around your house because you have all these years of acrylic. And I think what's interesting is this idea that we can technologically fix things. In other words, we can fix it with another technology. And so that's probably what we're looking for now. How do we fix with plastic? But we're likely going to go down the same path and create another mess.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. No, I completely agree. Every generation has their spectacular innovations. And then these realizations where they're like, oh no, that's not working. and I think that it's part of the process of human ingenuity and evolution, where, you know, we're creating new materials all the time. We're innovating. That's what these artists are doing. They're taking the materials that are available to them and they're using them in new and unexpected ways, right? And I think that's a little microcosm of what happens just in society as a whole, right? Somebody invents some material, we adopt it, people come up with more cool and interesting uses for it, it gets adopted more widely, and then all of a sudden we realize, yikes, hold on. So, you know, an undercurrent in all of my work and in all of these exhibits is hope, because I do have hope for the ability for us to solve the problems that this generation of plastics poses environmentally. And I think that what it takes is just a little awareness. And that's why I'm trying to chip away at the awareness piece and the public awareness piece. You know, the Art Students League show that I called The Plasticine was a really cool venue to hold it in, because it's this old 1800s, 1860s, I think, school building, and converted into classrooms and studios where artists can come in, and they have tons of summer camps, and it's a wonderful, active, lovely community in this gorgeous building. It's great that you bring up lead paint, because I'm pretty sure it's totally covered in lead paint. And if it's not, they painted over it, right? Because like that was that's the best.
Yeah,
the best method we have to seal it in, right? And you go down into the basement, and you're like, they certainly had asbestos in here, right? As insulation. Right. I mean, there's all of these liabilities that come with each generation of building and innovation, right? That we don't realize until we've been using a product for a little bit more time. And so I just view this as the plasticine. Plastic has proliferated in these 70 years since it's been manufactured at scale. And now we're coming to this point where we realize there's some problems and we need to fix those. But there are so many people working on cool solutions. This is where we can really geek out about the science that's happening in material design and material innovation. They're looking at, you know, like we mentioned earlier, that there are some microbes that they've identified that can break down plastics in certain scenarios. They're efforts to create plastics or alternative materials out of fungi, which would naturally just break back down. There are really cool efforts to make plastics that degrade under very specific conditions. So and or go back to their constituent parts. There are efforts to incinerate trash just generally, and make it super, super clean. So it's an alternative fuel source. So there are all these cool solutions that are being worked on. And I have faith that a few of them will pan out, you know? So.
I do too. That's, you know, that's a really good way of thinking about human innovation, creativity, that whole thing. It's really more than our technology. What you're talking about is our imaginations and our creativity and our ability to move it forward, which is that really how important the arts become in as a training ground for that kind of thought.
Yeah.
So where are you thinking of going next with your art?
Well, I mentioned the recycling thing is something that that keeps coming up, that people are not aware of the limitations of recycling. And I want them to more fully understand that. And there are lots of people working on it. So hopefully we'll make a dent, but that would definitely be next. But also just in general, I find that this approach that's not trying to lead with guilt, but is this kind of shared, collaborative, and hopeful approach of like, hey guys, come on, we can do better. I'd like to expand my reach personally so that I can bring that ethos to the conversation instead. So yeah, just trying to talk to more people.
That's great. I can see you one day doing an exhibit on a quilt of all medical stuff.
Oh yeah. know, that one's harder to transform though. When I mentioned the transformative nature, like people are very cued into that's a medical device.
That's a medical device, but it is pretty cool to imagine what you can do.
Sure.
We've been having a really good conversation together with really good guests. I don't want to mess your name up, but I'll just call you Cappy.
That's fine.
Munoz, about your work as an environmental artist, and also the continuing work that you're going to do as you do the work on 2D art as well through Natural Science Illustration. And this has really been a great intersection conversation between art and science because you have both in there, and I've enjoyed this thoroughly. Until next time, I'm Mark Kiesling, reminding you to tune in again when we explore more curiosities from the intersections of art and science.
You've been listening to Intersections, where art and science meet, with your host, Mark Kiesling, the founder of the Da Vinci Pursuit, and Krista Hoffman Longton, Assistant Dean for Faculty Affairs and Professional Development at the Indiana University School of Medicine. Just a reminder, the Da Vinci Pursuit brings together artists, scientists, and members of the community to engage in conversation that explore the intersections between art and science. We encourage you to explore further in conversation with others. Any of the ideas explored in today's show at www.thedaVinciPursuit.com.